the idea for the Counter Summit was initiated by a group of students from Columbia and also in Berkeley, so kind of a bi-coastal network that has worked to build this conference. And great news, we've registered over 700 people just for the first day of this Counter Summit, which is great, and we directed a lot of them to the labor demo today, which was an excellent demo. The estimate on the numbers there were 4,000 people. Excellent, yeah. And our hope was precisely to incorporate the Counter Summit, the workshops, the teach-ins, with the activities and the demonstrations for global justice that would be going on this weekend. So we invite all of you to participate in them. We have several speakers today. I should make a brief announcement. As our speakers are speaking, there are volunteers walking around the room, and if you have a particular question or concern or comment that you would like to make at the end of the speaking session, please signal one of them. They will hand you a note card. You can put your name on that, and then we will take those to the front, and then at the end, when I call off, I'll call off three speakers' names at one time. Please make your way to that microphone up here, and then you can ask your question directed towards one of our speakers or make your comment. So tonight, Peter Marcuse is speaking, Patrick Rainsborough is speaking, Michael Letwin is speaking, Suzanne Adley is speaking, Manning Marable is speaking, Amy Goodman is speaking, and the Reverend Al Sharpton is speaking. So it's a great lineup. Again, Students for Global Justice, welcome you to the first plenary session of the World Economic Forum Counter Summit. So, Professor Peter Marcuse is Professor of Urban Planning at Columbia University, the author of Globalizing Cities, A New Spatial Order, that's with a question mark at the end, that's off of Blackwell, and he's leaving early tonight because he's headed to the World Social Forum that has already begun. So, please welcome Professor Peter Marcuse.
My goodness, a student mobilization that starts on time. A new world is here already. September 11th has had a major impact on people in New York City and I think on people in the United States and to some extent around the world. And the reaction to it has colored almost everything that that the World Economic Forum is doing and that those of us that are critical of it are trying to do. The underlying issue for us, I think, is that the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center has been used as an argument for unity behind a program which sees free trade as the answer to terrorism, which defines internationalism as military coalitions, and which sees the United States as necessarily the leader and the decision maker for a so-called free world. It's a very strange argument that we're being presented with, that the reaction to terrorism is support for globalization as it is now. Because the globalization that's being supported is not what you might normally understand by the word globalization. It's a very strange, skewed form of globalization. I call it really existing globalization. It does not, for instance, include support for a world court or for any kind of international system of justice. It does not include support for international concerted action to avoid environmental damage. It does not include support for the Kyoto Accords. It does not include a more equitable division of resources among the world's peoples and the world's countries. There is supposed to be a conference in Monterrey next month called by the United Nations in which the issue of support by rich countries of poorer countries is supposed to come up. The United States has almost boycotted that meeting because among its programmatic issues was a doubling of support by rich countries for poorer countries. The United States, in fact, did boycott the meeting in Durban, an international meeting which you would think would be of the essence of a just globalization. But it was a meeting against racism and xenophobia, and the United States does not see opposition to racism and xenophobia as a part of what ought to be global. It withdrew from that. We are even questioning support for an almost universally approved set of rules embodied in the Geneva Conventions on the handling of those that are taken captive in armed conflicts. And this all in the name of globalization. And it's even a globalization in the free trade area that we do not consistently support when it does not meet the interests of American major businesses, the steel industry. If the steel industry feels it is being damaged by free trade, then we abandon, our government abandons the call for free trade and comes back to tariffs and protectionisms. So it's a very skewed form, this really existing globalization. That September 11th is being used to as an argument to have us support. And beyond that, September 11th, the reaction to it is being used to stifle criticism in the name of unity. It seems to me it's exactly now, after September 11th, that the criticism needs to be that much stronger and that much clearer and that much louder. September 11th has already been used as an argument to stifle criticism by talk show hosts, by professors, by newspaper columnists, by speakers. If you read the way in which the protests against the World Economic Forum are being handled in at least two of New York's major newspapers, the New York Post and the New York Daily News, you will find September 11th being used as a way of saying anybody that is not for the World Economic Forum essentially is against us, almost is of the same type as has produced terrorism. September 11th is being used to restrict access to public buildings. It's being used to limit the uses of public space. You will find that particularly as you go around Midtown Manhattan in the next few days, that the uses of the streets and public sidewalks is being restricted. And the argument is that we have seen what terrorism can do, and we don't want it, and therefore we will not allow even peaceful protest where there is any of what the police or the criminal authorities think is a danger. This is bad news. September 11th is being used precisely to limit the kinds of freedoms that presumably terrorism was attacking when the planes hit the World Trade Center. It's very ironic that those that speak most of protecting American values are the least concerned about protecting freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of protest. In New York City, the connection between September 11th and the skewed nature of globalism is strongly apparent in the way in which the money that is supposed to come to the city to repair some of the damage of September 11th is being spent. It is being spent in a fashion that will, in very skewed fashion, benefit those global firms, those financial firms, that part of the fire industries, the finance, insurance, and real estate firms that are in the financial district of New York. Yet the overwhelming majority of those that have lost their jobs and then have suffered economic damage because of September 11th do not live in Lower Manhattan. Only 22% live even in Manhattan itself. The large majority live outside. One would think that a fair use of the funds to deal with the terrorist attack would go to those people that suffered from it. That is, would go not only to the financial district, but would go to people in the city as a whole, to people in New Jersey, to people in Connecticut. Among those that have filed for help from the Federal Emergency Management Agency because they have had trouble paying their mortgages or paying their rents because of the attack are people from as far away as Florida and California. The damage that has been caused is nationwide. It is a skewed form of repair to concentrate funds only on Lower Manhattan. There is an overwhelming favoritism to the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned about many years ago. If you look at the budget proposals that the president has put forward, you will find an overwhelming flow of money to the military and to those corporations and firms that produce for the military. A very skewed form of budgeting. So that I see September 11th as increasing the need for protest, increasing the need to take the kinds of actions that are represented here. It seems to me that more than ever, we need to be clear on what really existing globalization is, what it means, and what it produces for the world's people. The inequalities around the world that are generated by globalization. We need to be clear more now than ever on what alternatives to that form of globalization can be, to what we really want. And we need to be clear, particularly in a mobilization such as this, and particularly in the events in New York City that are going on today, we need to be clear that protest is a positive act, that what we are doing is not simply saying no to what they are doing. What we are saying is yes for a just form of globalization and for a juster world. I think it's very encouraging that there is this kind of attendance at a mobilization such as this. Students and workers have traditionally been in the forefront of progressive movements, and that is as true today as it has been in the past. I think this is an encouraging sign. The World Social Forum that's taking place in Porto Alegre starting today and going through at the same time as the World Economic Forum, the World Social Forum will have at least 10 times as many in attendance as the World Economic Forum. They will be from all countries around the globe. They will be grassroots people, and they will be working again positively to formulate what another world might be like, not the world that is being prepared for us at the World Economic Forum. I'm very fortunate to be able to go to the World Social Forum. I hope to bring them some greetings from you and from this mobilization. It means, unfortunately, that I need to leave because I'm going there directly from here. But it seems to me one of the encouraging things that has happened after September 11th that not only have the forces of really existing globalization been strengthened, but that also the forces for a just globalization have become clearer in what they want and have also become more active. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Peter Marcuse. Our next speaker is Patrick Rainsborough of the Rainforest Action Network. Great. The Rainforest Action Network, if some of you know, is a human rights and environmental group that works to protect old growth forests and the rights of their traditional inhabitants. So please welcome Patrick Rainsborough.
Well, it is certainly a pleasure to be here tonight. So fess up, who's got tickets? Who out there's got a ticket to the World Economic Forum? Anyone? Nobody? None of you had $25,000 to cough up? Well, I see I am clearly in a crowd of low baggers, but that's okay. Fortunately, we're having our own far more fun schmoozy global cocktail party here that hopefully the result will be one a lot more productive than what's going to happen downtown. And since we're told that the World Economic Forum is about addressing the issues of our times, that these are the political, economic, and cultural elites who are going to solve the world's problems, I think it's appropriate that we here talk about the world's problems. So I want to start, unfortunately, with a bunch of bad news. Because from the perspective I'm coming, which is essentially a biocentric critique of the corporate global economy, there's a lot of very, very bad news. We're standing at a historic time when two significant historic themes are working themselves out in our generation. 500 years of colonialism and organized white supremacy and genocide and conquest in this hemisphere and around the world, and 200 years of rampant industrialization. And that's pushed us to the point where literally the life support systems of the planet are on the brink of collapse. I want to talk about some of the issues that I work on in terms of the world's forests. I don't know how many people out there know what an old-growth forest is, but it's a primary, fully functioning, intact forest ecosystem. Now, that means it's a forest that's never been impacted by human beings. And of the original old-growth forest cover of this planet, only 22% remains, less than one quarter. And a lot of people, particularly folks who are of the more urban set, might think, well, you know, what does that have to do with me? I'm busy fighting for justice in my own communities, fighting the issues that affect me. What do large tracts of wilderness have to do with me? And the reality is, an essential message that we need to get across to the world is that those forests and wilderness areas in general are the remaining intact biological wealth of this planet, the real wealth of this planet. Those 22% of the world's forests contain somewhere between 50 and 75% of all life on planet Earth, all plant and animal species. They contain around 75% of all traditional indigenous cultures, remaining in the tiny chunks left of the world's old-growth forests. Yet they continue to fall at an alarming rate. Likewise, we're seeing the ecological crisis expressed in what's loosely called global warming, but is much more accurately called global climate destabilization. It's continually amazing to me because we are fortunate, despite the incredible corporate censorship of the media, to have a lot of information at our disposal, a lot of times too much information. And for folks who follow the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, it's amazing to me that these stories get tucked away on page 17, page 18, page 24. The latest findings from this panel, which is made up of about 1,500 of the world's top climate scientists, is that we can expect over the next century our planet, planet Earth, to heat up between 3 and 10 degrees. 3 to 10 degrees centigrade. Now, to put that in perspective, the last ice age was about varying at different times between 3 and 7 degrees cooler. Those are the type of cataclysmic global changes we're talking about, the kind of destabilization that we're looking at over the next century. happening rapidly. The folks who are actually, interestingly enough, tracking a lot of the impacts of global warming expressed through extreme weather are the insurance industry. And the world's largest reinsurer, Munich Re, has compiled a great deal of statistics about the price tag that global warming is costing them. And in 1998 alone, the year at which global warming has taken the most significant impact, the price tag of global warming, which we hear very little about, was $87 billion, was 300 million people who lost their homes and were displaced, and 32,000 people who were killed. So when we think, what are the real issues of our times underlying a lot of the symptoms that we see? We're currently living through the sixth mass extinction on planet Earth right now. As we speak, the Smithsonian Institute estimates that today, while we were all going about our business of trying to create a global justice movement, that approximately 374 plant and animal species went extinct. The reality is they really have no idea, because they don't know how many species are left in the world's forests as they're being cut down. But what that means is essentially we're shredding the web of life. This is a biological meltdown, and it gets to one of the big flawed assumptions of our times. Our entire society is encouraged to think that humanity is the most important species on the planet. Now, the reality is humanity is just one strand within a web of life. We're dependent on the rest of this web of life. We're dependent on it for clean air, clean water, for the medicines and food crops we rely on. And essentially, when we get into these false debates about jobs versus the environment, or whether we can afford to make the kind of global transitions that are needed to deal with the global ecological crisis, and say, why should we save one snail-toed starter species here, or this type of slug? The reality is, if you look at planet Earth as an incredibly complex machine, something we don't really understand, think of it as an airplane. Now, you'd have to be a pretty foolish mechanic flying on your airplane to open up the engine and say, I don't know what this one does, let's pull that one out of there. I don't know what this cog does, let's pull that one out of there. That's literally what we're doing. We're not taking little snips at the web of life. We're shredding the web of life. And we stand at this point in a very exciting time, a historic juncture in this larger battle we're all a part of, in the struggles between civil society and corporate rule, the struggle between a people's globalization and corporate globalization, the decision about what is going to be globalized, because that's the biggest lie that they've tried to perpetuate about us, is that we're not globalizers, that we want to live in isolation, that we want to live in a vacuum. The reality is we're the original think globally, act locally people. We're the original people who recognized along our movements and the basis with a lot of traditional societies that we have only one planet and we have to be better stewards of it. So we stand looking at a choice. We can have a vibrant, diverse world where there's traditional indigenous cultures, where there's a wealth of life that's part of supporting us and living in conjunction with us. Or we can descend in the direction that those involved in the World Economic Forum and the corporate globalizers want, which is essentially global corporate consumer monoculture. Because ultimately that's what they're about. They're about the death of diversity. They're about the death of life. They're about homogenization and assimilation. And one of the things that a lot of times we don't hear, because our movement can sometimes be a little self-congratulatory a little too early, is that there's nothing particularly new about globalization. Globalization, certainly in this hemisphere, has been going on for 500 years, and there's been resistance for 500 years, and that resistance is continuing. And I'd like to read to you from a communique that was sent out to the world from a community of people in Colombia, a traditional indigenous community called the Uwa people. Are folks familiar with the Uwa and their struggle? People have heard about them. These are messages that have resonated around the world and are a true example of our globalization, the globalization of hope and democracy and justice and environmental protection. But the Uwa, for those of you who don't know, is they're not an uncontacted people, but they are an unassimilated people. And in fact, as part of their stories, the way they resisted colonization was for a clan of the Uwa in the 1600s to commit collective suicide by walking backwards over a 1,600-foot cliff. The cliff of death, as they call it. And the remainders of their society lived quite peacefully in their cloud forest homes in what's now northeastern Colombia until the early 90s, when a new wave of conquistadors showed up in their territory. The conquistadors of multinational oil corporations who were looking for the black gold underneath their land. the oil that they call ruira in their own language, the blood of Mother Earth. So as this campaign intensified and they began to realize the destruction that oil exploitation would bring to their communities, not only in terms of environmental destruction and the destruction of their values and their homeland, but bringing the incredibly bloody civil war that's raging in Colombia into their territory, they decided to make a very powerful statement and send it out to the world that rather than be killed, rather than be assimilated, rather than lose their homelands and their way of life, they would choose again to commit collective suicide. And they sent this message out to the world. This is from August 10th of 1998. And this is a message that if it had come from Mars, it would be on the front page of every newspaper. The reality is the sentiments in this statement are so distant from the underlying twisted values of global capitalism that it could have come from Mars. The words of the Uwa people. Oil is the blood of Mother Earth, and to take the oil is for us worse than killing your own mother. If you kill the Earth, then no one will live. We will in no way sell our Mother Earth. To do so would be to give up on our work of collaborating with the spirits to protect the heart of the world, which sustains and gives life to the rest of the universe. It would be to go against our own origins and those of all existence. We are seeking an explanation for this progress that goes against life. We are demanding that this kind of progress stop, that oil exploitation in the heart of the earth is halted, that the deliberate bleeding of the earth stop. We ask that our brothers and sisters from other races and cultures unite in the struggle that we are undertaking. We believe that this struggle has to become a global crusade to defend life. That's a communique from 1998 that helped launch an international solidarity movement against an oil company and, most importantly, against the financial institutions that back them up. And it speaks to a lot of the flawed assumptions of our time, what's meant by progress, what's meant by development, what's meant by a fossil fuel-based economy. Fundamentally, the belief that we're separate from the earth and we're not dependent on the earth, that the earth is ours to rape and pillage, to exploit, to commodify for personal gain. Behind that the model by which we should assess our progress is one of unlimited economic growth. I like to think of it as the flowchart mentality. Over here we have resources in the middle we have incredibly complex, intricate systems that we've worked out to make out lots of cool stuff. Resources in, cool stuff, pollution out. And we never think about which direction these things are going in, and realizing that we live on a planet that's bound within certain limits, and we must respect those. As a radical ecologist, I look to nature for my models of meaningful social structure. And when I look at what the global capitalist economy has created, I can see only one thing in nature that represents it. And that is, as it's been said so eloquently, the ideology of the cancer cell. Something based on unlimited growth till it literally pushes to the point where we kill the host. That host is us, planet Earth. And essentially what we're looking at, what the World Economic Forum is offering us up, and offering us up in their twisted logic as progress and prosperity, is actually a doomsday economy, pushing us within the next generation to the largest biological and ecological crisis this planet has ever seen. So that was the bad news. The good news, fortunately, is when you follow this metaphor through, and you look to the natural world. Fortunately, I think there's something that's already happening that we all represent. And that's that an organism under attack will create antibodies. And the antibodies will grow, and they'll spread, and they will identify the invader, and they will work to transform it. And I think that's what's happening all around us. We're seeing a push towards transformative culture. People are recognizing that in this generation, we don't have the choice to not be radicals. To paraphrase my favorite Thoreau quote, Thoreau says, "For every 1,000 people hacking at the branches of the tree of evil, only one is hacking at the root." That's our job, to ensure that more and more people start hacking at the root. And very briefly in conclusion, I want to suggest to you what I think that root is. And I think that where we'll find it is when we look to the actual assumptions of the global financial system itself and the people who are running the global economy. I look at the financial system, and particularly the giant private banks. I'm involved with an international coalition running a campaign against Citigroup, the largest financial institution on the planet. And to me, I've come to recognize that as one of the key nerve centers of global destruction, the jugular of the global economy, the flow of money around the planet. And then it's essential for our movement to step forward and recognize that the ecological crisis is a symptom of a deeper crisis, a crisis in democracy. And as long as we allow the same corporations that profit off of this narrow vision of destroying the life support systems of the planet, as long as we allow these people to write the rules of the global economy, we're never going to solve the ecological crisis. We're never going to have a democratic, just, and ecologically sane global society. And so I'm very excited by the movement that's emerging in this country in solidarity with the traditions of popular resistance around the world, where people are recognizing that the age of single-issue politics is over, that we're all in this together, environmentalists, students, people of faith, anarchists, communists, labor organizers. We're creating one movement that's diverse enough to create space for all of us and diverse enough to actually get to the root of this problem. So I want to end on one point that provides a lot of inspiration for me. And that's a pretty bumper sticker version of Schopenhauer's Models of Truth, a 19th century philosopher who says that truth goes through three different stages. The first is ridicule, and I think a lot of us in our work have been ridiculed. The second is violent repression, and there's been a whole lot of violent repression around the world, and we're starting to get a real taste of it here in this country. And then finally, the third phase is that the truth is accepted as self-evident. And that's what's happening. We're part of a common sense revolution, a revolution in consciousness, a revolution that's affirming basic values of supporting life and democracy and justice. And I think that these are spreading. And I want to thank everybody here for all the work that they've done and the work that they'll continue to do and what will happen in the streets this weekend and, more importantly, what will happen when we all go back home as we continue to build this movement and continue to build our links. So let's show them that the revolution is already happening and take it to the streets and take it to our communities and let them know that we're going to think big because our times demand it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Patrick, so much for that inspiring speech. For those coming in late, again, this is the first plenary session of the Students for Global Justice's World Economic Forum Counter Summit. Just a bit of, yeah, it was really great, Patrick touched upon, you know, people coming together, forging links, and building for not just teaching each other, coming together to teach each other, but also join each other in the streets. So I encourage all of you to do that this weekend. Our panel today is called Globalization, Militarism, the Neoliberal Agenda, and Their Discontents. And our next speaker is Michael Letwin of the Legal Aid Attorneys Association at UAW Local 2325 and a co-convener of New York City Labor Against the War. Please welcome Michael Letwin.
Thank you. It's a nicer welcome than I get when I go home sometimes, especially these days with all the events. I want to talk for a few minutes about some of the connections that I think this plenary session and this conference is making, particularly between globalization and the war, because I guess it goes without saying that it's not really possible to talk about globalization now, if it ever was, without starting and probably finishing with the war, because that is such a dominant reality after 9/11. And I guess the first thing to say about the connection is that globalization, and you've heard other people describe it, and I won't repeat the description, but the essentials of globalization and the blowback from globalization is what, of course, led to 9/11 to begin with. And for those of us who are in New York City, which is where, of course, we all are now, and those of us especially who were here on 9/11 and who've experienced that event, that terrible tragedy, that terrible crime, and what has happened since that time, there really is a need to see that link, to realize and to recognize that if it wasn't for the United States policies, economic injustice, supporting for years and years organizations like the Taliban and many others, building them up as part of the Cold War, unleashing them against the enemies of the United States government, and then seeing it blow back on us, because it wasn't the United States government officials who got killed on 9/11, it was ordinary people in this country. So that blowback, the results, the consequences of those policies is something that we have all had to pay for again and again and again. And 9/11 is one very prime example of that, which obviously has traumatized everybody in this room and well beyond. And I think the other end of it is that just as that those policies of economic injustice, support for brutal dictatorships abroad, unrestrained violence on the part of the United States has led to 9/11, so 9/11 has led to really just an intensification of those same policies under the pretext of responding to 9/11. And so that's a very ironic situation that we're dealing with here, that on the one hand, it's American policies in large part that led to 9/11, and then it's American policies of the same type that are escalated using our sorrow and our grief and those of the families of the people who died on 9/11 in the World Trade Center as an excuse, as a pretext to take those same policies to an even greater level. So what has happened since 9/11 along those lines? Well, we've had war every which way. We've had war against Afghanistan, in which, according to various analyses, at least as many people have now been killed, Afghanis, as died in the World Trade Center, probably far more than that. Under American bombs, cluster bombs, as a result of American military action that has accelerated starvation and misery in Afghanistan, it's led to unapologetic and open alliance more than ever by the United States with some of the most ruthless regimes abroad. It's led at home to unapologetic war profiteering by corporations that within days of 9/11 had managed to get themselves billions and billions and billions of dollars in economic givebacks to those corporations, the airline industry being the best example, $15 billion within just a week or two of 9/11. And it's gone on from there. I read something in the paper the other day that said that the F-22 program, which is a fighter plane that they're now going to build, it was going to be canceled probably before 9/11 since there's no way for even the government to justify it or try to. Nonetheless, that's now going forward at the price of approximately $200 billion. These are just pieces of what has happened on the economic front since 9/11. And of course, at the same time, there has been the largest attack on immigrants in this country since probably the Second World War and the internment of Japanese Americans, the unrestrained attack on civil liberties. And so all of these things have been explained in terms of the war, and in fact they are expressions of the war, and there really is no way to separate these policies from the war that they're part of. And it's for that reason that New York City Labor Against the War came together. And to look at that in context, part of the context is this discussion of globalization, part of it is the response to 9/11 by the United States, but it also goes back to the path of labor itself. You know that, without going too far back, you know that in terms of the globalization movement, that labor had made something of an appearance in Seattle, or part of labor had. The Turtle Teamster Alliance, as it was called, which was a brief moment of hope that perhaps official labor would in fact be socially active. As you know, labor in this country has been in very severe decline for decades, and part of that decline, at least, many reasons for it, but part of that decline has been the failure to ally itself with progressive social movements. So Seattle held out the promise, at least, of some reversal in that direction. But unfortunately, after Seattle, labor, even that part of labor that was involved in Seattle, pulled back, and the subsequent events against globalization, especially the summer conventions in Philadelphia and LA in 2000, were really largely absent of labor. And there's a lot of different reasons for that. Some of it are labor's fault. I think some of it is the fact that most unions or union people, even if they're going to get involved, are not necessarily willing to put themselves in a situation where they're going to jeopardize their jobs and perhaps their lives by the kind of some of the direct action that went on in those events. But nonetheless, 9/11 again raised the question of how labor was going to respond to globalization, to all the injustice and inequity of it, given what had happened on 9/11. And I'm sorry to tell you that you probably know that the official position of labor as a whole has been to support the war and to support the government. If you go to the AFL-CIO website, AFLCIO.org, it'll tell you as much. If you go to some of the most virulent unions, in particular, thinking now of the machinists, one of the craft unions in the AFL-CIO, you will find statements that basically call for nuking Afghanistan. So those are some of the responses that labor, official labor, had to the war. And again, it was for that reason that New York City Labor Against the War, which is a very small voice of dissent, but nonetheless many of us felt was an important statement to make. And so a group of us, among different unions in this city, within the days and weeks after 9/11, came together and said, you know, we're not going to allow the only voice of labor on the issue of the war to be that pro-war voice. That small as we may be in our opposition and in our dissent, small in number as we may be, nonetheless we felt we had an obligation to stand up and say something different. And we tried to say it different in a statement which I'll actually ask for some volunteers to help me distribute here, called New York City Labor Against the War.
Thanks. Thank you.
And because I'm handing it out, I'm not going to read it to you. I'm not going to make you suffer through that. And it's not on the exam. But the thing I want to say about it is that it was an attempt to echo the role, in particular, that a group called Vietnam Veterans Against the War played 30 and 35 years ago. How many people here remember Vietnam Veterans Against the War? Well, I think it's a tribute to that organization that you do remember it so well, because the thing, for those of you who don't know about Vietnam Veterans Against the War, is they were part of the movement against the war in Vietnam that probably had the single most important impact within that movement of any of us. Because important as the student movement was, important as the community movement was, important as all opposition to the war was, Vietnam Veterans Against the War were a group of working class guys who had ended up in Vietnam, black, white, Latino, Asian. Because they were working class guys is why they ended up in Vietnam, either drafted or because that's what their parents had always done. Their dads had always gone to war like that, so they went to war. And they came back and said, you know, we, as people who have fought this war, realize that this war is wrong, and we're going to come home and say so. And in fact, it was the revolt within the American military on the part of those working class guys and all their friends which really led, at least in the last moment, to the defeat of the United States in Vietnam, because that army essentially refused to fight. And so that organization, VVAW, probably had more impact in terms of bringing that war to a halt than any other part of our anti-war movement at that time. And so it was sort of in that image, not because we were in the army or because we necessarily thought we would have as much impact as that, but rather because we saw that as a model of what could be done, especially from the point of view of working class people, that we tried to put this together. And you'll see, therefore, that this statement is not primarily argued in terms of pacifism, because that really wasn't where we were coming from. And you'll also see, I hope, that it doesn't come across as being the left talking to itself. At least we tried very hard for it not to be. Rather, what we wanted to do was to express on the behalf of ordinary workers, to ordinary workers, why it was not in the interests of workers to support the war. And by implication, of course, raising all kinds of issues of globalization. And the basic points that we tried to make in that regard are the points in bold at the bottom. No war, justice, not vengeance, opposition to racism and defense of civil liberties, aid for the needy, not the greedy, and no labor austerity. And so it was an attempt to bring those kinds of politics, or at least raise that flag within labor. So what kind of response have we gotten to this? Well, you'll see that if you turn it inside, there's 804 signers of this statement. Now, that's not a huge number in terms of the overall number of trade unionists, whether in New York City or abroad, but I think it is interesting and important that there were, or have been to date, about 450 to 500 trade unionists, first of all, in New York City, where 9/11 took place, where we, all of us, you and we, and the people that signed this statement and their families, were here for 9/11, we saw 9/11, many of us know people who died in 9/11, and it was because of that experience that so many people, I think, were willing to stand up and say, yes, I'm a union member in New York City, and don't for a minute think that I support the policies of the United States government in response to 9/11. And that the hope, at least, is that that, just as VVAW 30 years ago had credibility to make that statement against the war in a way that they did, the hope, at least, is that similarly, workers in New York City making this statement have an important moral high ground with which to make it. Doesn't mean that we're more right than anybody else, but it does mean that people who you might not necessarily think would take this position are taking this position. And so we began to put this list together. This list continues to grow. It obviously is a very small minority, but it is not an inconsequential minority. And you'll see when you look at this statement that there are 15 different union officers in New York City, or union presidents, essentially, who've signed this statement. They have not signed it on behalf of their unions, except in one or two cases. For example, I don't speak for my union on this issue. But nonetheless, they were willing to stand up and put themselves in the line in this way and say, you know what, we're willing to take this position, and we ask our members and other trade unionists to take this position. We're going to have two workshops in this conference that I invite you to come to where we can talk about this in more detail. One is tomorrow, or they're both tomorrow, actually. One is at 10 o'clock, organizing New York City labor against the war, and that's at Hamilton 302 at 10 o'clock, where we'll have more time to both talk about what this experience has been and to hear from you about it and your thoughts and your responses. Also at 1:30, as part of the Fighting New York City Budget Cuts, we will be participating in that as well. But I want to end this session, or my part of this session tonight, by just stressing this. You know, often it seems as though there is not common ground to spread our movement, that is, this movement against globalization, against war, beyond the usual suspects. And I hope that this statement is one piece of evidence that that's not the case, that we can, in fact, reach beyond our normal ranks and build a movement that at least can hope to become a mass movement of ordinary people, which is what it needs to be if it's going to be able to succeed, especially working class people. And today, there was an event that how many people were at the garment workers demonstration in Midtown today, the AFL-CIO demonstration? Well, that demonstration was not an anti-war demonstration, but it was an anti-globalization demonstration. It was an anti-globalization demonstration that brought hundreds and perhaps thousands of workers to that location to fight against sweatshops and to fight against at least the symptoms of much of what we're talking about. And it's with those kinds of events, as well as the fight against the attack on civil liberties, the attack on immigrants, with people who aren't necessarily against the war, but who can be moved around those immediate issues, that we need to build alliances. And so I urge you to come, especially to the event on Saturday at 12 o'clock, demonstration at 59th Street and 5th Avenue, and to bring people who you don't normally think about bringing, and let's build a movement that really can make a difference. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael Letwin. Just one correction. We've been having some many misadventures with space here for our counter summit. The workshops for tomorrow have all been moved to Lerner Hall. All the workshops were in Lerner Hall today, so tomorrow's workshops also will be in Lerner Hall. That was an update that was made today. So please, when you register tomorrow, or if you've already registered, when you check in tomorrow, check on the room location changes. And speaking of space, we want to thank St. John's for providing this beautiful space for us to gather. Students for Global Justice did have some brief encounters with the university administration. They were worried about outside influences influencing our young minds. But we did get the space back, which is good, but St. John's did come through with the plenary session space, and it is greatly appreciated. Because, actually, we've got a full house, and it's another update on numbers. You know, when we first initiated this counter summit, we expected 350, maybe, at the most. Today, we registered over 750 attendees just for the first day alone. So it's excellent. And you know, we have workshops tomorrow, as Michael said, and please come to those. We want to provide that space so we can teach each other and also plug each other into the demonstrations this weekend, of which I hope you all will be a part. A quick reminder, there are volunteers walking around, so if you have questions for at the end, please signal to one of them. They will hand you a speaker slip. They'll take it in, pass it up front, and then we'll call your names at the end. You can line up the microphone here. Next up is Suzanne Adley of the Al Auda. That's the Palestinian Right of Return Coalition. On that, there is a wonderful workshop tomorrow on the struggle for justice in Palestine, solidarity activism, with many great groups that do work here in the United States and also internationally around the struggle for justice in Palestine. And also, there is a Palestinian solidarity contingent for the marches on Saturday, so please look into finding out more about that. And so, next up, Suzanne Adley.
Just for those of you who don't know, Al Auda is the Arab word for return, and the name of the coalition is the Palestine Rights Return Coalition. I'm here today to speak about Palestine. To begin with the situation in Palestine and the U.S. support for Israel, it is a clear, very clear manifestation of the economic and military demands that the U.S. yields. Nowhere else in the world is the blatant disregard for international law and human rights more apparent. And nowhere else is the hand of the United States and U.S. strategic interests more obvious. The neoliberal agenda is clearly threatened by signs of instability and resistance in any region. The Palestinian Intifada is a clear source of instability that has shown itself to arouse violence to arouse the voice of dissent in the Middle East, sometimes violently and sometimes nonviolently. In yesterday's issue of the Israeli Haaretz, Danny Rubenstein is an Israeli commenter who was commenting on what he detected to be a particular fear of the president of Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, as he was meeting with some Israeli officials. And he was saying something along the lines of the Palestinian conflict. He was saying that the regional stability, thank you, rooted his quote, thank you. I didn't. Okay. His quote was, regional stability rooted in containment of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the crucial present interest of all Arab governments, with Egypt in the lead. The Israeli occupation over Palestine symbolizes both historical colonial oppression and present U.S. domination. This dominance has not only manifested itself in the U.S.-Israeli strategic alliance, but it has also manifested itself in direct military action in the region, namely Iraq and Afghanistan, and support for the repressive regimes in the region, namely Jordan, Egypt, the Gulf nations. and the force, and it also manifests itself more so now in the forced neoliberal policies that are diminishing the quality of life of the people in the Middle East. The Palestinian struggle for self-determination is considered, for these reasons, an opponent to U.S. hegemony in the Middle East and the stability of the Arab regimes. Globalization is dependent on the world market determining the future of nation states and making sure that the people of those nation states do not or cannot determine their own future, especially their economic future. If the Palestinian uprising, the Intifada, can sustain itself as a legitimate struggle, whether successful or not, if it sustains itself as a legitimate struggle, it can embolden others to call for determining their own future as well. The U.S. response has been to give Israel the green light to continue a massive terror campaign against the Palestinians, even while violating numerous international laws, and to fund that campaign with billions of dollars. Now the U.S. says, you are with us or you are with the terrorists, and supporters of Palestine are definitely not with the United States, so we must be with the terrorists. Complying with the U.S. war on terrorism is supported, and U.S.-supported regimes in the region that have brutally repressed supporters of the, complying with the U.S. war on terrorism and U.S.-supported regimes in the region have brutally repressed supporters of the Intifada. Those regimes who comply with the United States have brutally suppressed supporters of the Intifada in their country. I recall not too long ago the Egyptian government kidnapping a leader of a secular, popular Egyptian committee for Palestine from the streets of Egypt. In doing this, the president of Egypt is not only complying with U.S. demands in the region, but he's also trying to maintain his own stability in the region as well, as the other regimes do. The movements such as the pro-Palestinian movement in Egypt or in Jordan or in other areas of the Middle East are recognizing that globalization is leading to a recolonization of the region through mounting debt, structural adjustment, and trade policies. And for that reason, as they stood up to call for an end to the Israeli oppression against the Intifada, they also started to include in their demands that people start to oppose the neoliberal policies that have diminished their quality of life. At the same time that these movements are realizing that they are being recolonized, through these types of globalization, Palestine itself is struggling against the same colonial power that began to arrive in their land in the late 19th century. In 1948, with the backing of imperial nations, Israel was declared a state, and 500,000 Palestinians were expelled from their homes. Thousands were massacred, and over 500 villages were destroyed, taken over by Zionists who hoped to erase the history of the land. This tragedy is known to the Arab people as the catastrophe, or El Nakba in Arabic. In 1967, Israel went further and forcefully took the areas of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. A brutal military occupation was established, systematically violating the human rights of Palestinians through violence, humiliation, house demolitions, establishing illegal settlements, expropriation of land, water, and other resources, erasing of their history, imprisonment, torture. These violations and this legal oppressive Israeli occupation persists today. Palestinians have lived under these intolerable conditions for over 50 years. The Intifada, the first one in the 80s, and the one that is happening right now was inevitable. The 1993 Oslo agreements that was set up to thwart the first Intifada also set up the region for an inevitable second uprising. Falsely labeled as a peace process, the Oslo Accords were set up by Israel and the United States to legitimize the occupation of Palestine in a system of apartheid and to legitimize the Palestinian legal and moral right to struggle for liberation. In fact, the Oslo Accords never even recognized the Israeli occupation to begin with. It ignored the vital issues of land and water rights and the right for 4 million Palestinian refugees to return back to their lands from which they were exiled. The only thing Oslo succeeded in doing was setting up an oppressive Palestinian police force, which is today blamed for the violence and is under direct Israeli attack. In the post-Oslo era, the Palestinians were physically separated from one another, trapped in bantustans, not unlike the ones that we saw in South Africa. The building of illegal settlements doubled in the post-Oslo era. Housing demolitions increased. More Jewish-only roads were built, and an almost permanent closure was placed on the Palestinians, imposed through checkpoints, roadblocks, and systematic violence. The standard of living and quality of life became worse, even under the pre-Oslo occupation. It was worse than then. Even more, the Palestinians became economically dependent on external means of money, of charity, of loans, and they had no infrastructure and were not able to sustain themselves. The second intifada that came as a response to these pre-Oslo intolerable conditions is still going on today, even under full closure and constant bombings by U.S.-made bombs. Funerals have become the means for protest. A campaign of total ethnic cleansing and genocide is right now threatening the Palestinian people. Since September of 2000, over 1,000 Palestinians have been killed, the majority of them children, the majority of them were unarmed, and many of them not even involved in any type of protest at the time that they were killed. Over 14,000 have been wounded, and when I say wounded, they've been permanently crippled, permanently blinded, to ensure that they cannot grow up to be strong opponents of the Israeli occupation. In the past year and a half alone, over 400 homes were demolished. Palestinian homes were demolished in the Gaza Strip alone. Torturing of prisoners continued, even children who have been arrested, teenagers who have been arrested, and settler violence escalated in the past year and a half, going completely unpunished, and assassinations of grassroots leaders became rampant. Inside the Israeli apartheid system, a full-blown war is now being waged against the Palestinian people. Resistance to this oppression in Palestine, in the region, and even here is being deemed as an act of terrorism by the United States. However, you know, what no one can deny is that whatever happens in Palestine, whatever happens to the Palestinians, in effect, is also happening to Israel. It's affecting Israeli society, economically, psychologically. Israel is a military state, and young Israeli citizens are perpetrating more and more war crimes on a daily basis. So what happens next? Complete destruction or more negotiations? Whatever the outcome of diplomacy, nothing is acceptable without recognition of the economic and social rights of all Palestinians. Liberation or independence is meaningless if the economic and social discrimination against the Palestinians remains. Any type of settlement must include the elimination of these inequities and disadvantages inflicted on the Palestinian people living in the West Bank, the Palestinian people living in the Gaza Strip, in East Jerusalem, in Israel proper, and the Palestinians in exile. Economic and social rights are human rights. The right of return is a human right. And human rights will not be negotiated, and they will not be bargained. So what are the options? I'm not really here to give you one, but just to talk slightly about some of the ones that are being talked about. There's a growing movement in the Jewish community to return to the 67 borders, to lift the occupation against the Palestinian people. And soon there's going to be an advertisement in the New York Times being put out for the Jewish community to profess this. The only question I have is that Using the solution of the 67 borders, what happens to the refugees? Others are talking about the one-state solution, about a secular democratic state where all the inhabitants live under equal social and economic rights, and that would be a goal of the globalization movement. However, when talking about this, we have to be realistic. I support this idea, but we have to talk about the viability. How viable is it when the Israeli left itself is so invisible, and the Israeli left that is there is so finds that keeping the Jewish character of the state is so important? While a very comprehensive and deep discussion needs to take place about these solutions, right now there is an immediacy to the situation, an urgency to the situation that nobody can deny. Nobody in this audience can ignore it. The Palestinians clearly need your help. They need the help of every single human being in this country and around the world. They cannot fight Israel alone. International law will not protect them. International law, in theory, should protect them, but it hasn't protected them. And right now, it doesn't look like it's going to be able to. And the Palestinians are not just fighting Israel, they're fighting the United States. It is a gross underestimation to say that the United States is an ally or supporter of Israel. They are an accomplice. They are an accomplice in the crime known as the Israeli occupation. It's even more absurd to say that the U.S. is a fair mediator, or a CIA agent is a fair mediator in the peace process. But they've said it. The Palestinians need the citizens of the United States and the international community to stand up to protect them. They need to establish, we need to establish here in the United States and everywhere, a popular committee to call for an end to the Israeli apartheid and the Israeli occupation. Very much in the same way we called for the end to the South African apartheid. So, what we need to do is begin to target USA to Israel. Every year, every citizen of Israel receives $14,000 from the United States. $5 billion in direct aid, $5 billion in indirect aid, much of it reinvested in Israeli and American military industry. We need to target USA to Israel. We need to call for an economic boycott of all Israeli products, companies, and corporations that support Israel, financially and politically. Demand that your institutions divest from Israeli companies, and if such measures do not affect the companies economically, at least they will affect them symbolically. We must call for a divestment in Israeli companies. We must also call for a diplomatic boycott of Israel. And I have to say that, for example, in calling for a diplomatic boycott of Israel, for example, we should explain to leaders like Al Sharpton of the National Action Network that in visiting Israel, you are recognizing the right for an apartheid state to exist. I spoke with a representative of the National Action Network the day that Sharpton left for Israel to say that we need to remember what happened in Durban, South Africa. We need to remember that the international community recognized Israel as an apartheid state. And the members of the National Action Network assured me that they were going there to meet with both sides, with the Israeli side and the Palestinian side. My response is, Palestinians and the Israelis are not equal. The Israelis are the oppressors, and the Palestinians are the oppressed. And I must include that I think it is an absolute disgrace that the president of South Africa met with Ariel Sharon last June. Especially in light of the fact that Israel was the most ardent supporter of white South African government. Also, every time Ariel Sharon steps into this country, comes to New York City, comes to D.C., we need to be there to greet him, to greet that war criminal. And he's going to be here on February 7th in D.C., if you can make it. We need to support the indictment of Ariel Sharon in Belgium for crimes against humanity. And I applaud the hundreds of internationals, of Americans and Europeans who have gone to Palestine to perform direct action against the Israeli military. It's very courageous. And I'm going to join them next June. And I think that those hundreds of internationals who are going there to form sort of a popular movement to protect the Palestinians, I think those numbers can grow into thousands. We need to stop this Israeli-American war against the Palestinians, and we need to crush the propaganda machine that is branding all forms of resistance as terrorism. Join the struggle for self-determination everywhere. The leaders of the World Economic Forum do not have a right to determine the fate of the Palestinians or anybody else. Free Palestine.
Thank you, Suzanne Adley. Thank you. Thank you for being part of the struggle for justice in Palestine. A quick announcement. Michael Letwin forgot to ask the trade unionists in the room here to sign and pass up to the front the New York City Labor Against the War statement. Please, as labor activists, as people against this war, if you could sign that and pass it to the front, he'd greatly appreciate it. Our next speaker is Professor Manning Marable, Columbia University Professor of African American Studies, the Director of the Institute for African American Studies, author of innumerable books, Chairperson of the United New York, that's the local chapter of the Black Radical Congress, and a quick apologies from Professor Manning Marable. He has to make a political meeting after he speaks, so he will be excusing himself. Like Professor Marcuse, who had to leave for the World Social Forum, Professor Manning Marable is an example of the engaged intellectual, the scholar activist. So please welcome Professor Manning Marable.
Thank you. One of the litmus tests of building a successful movement is that you've got several political meetings going on in the same evening. I think that with the events of this weekend, there will be many more evenings where there are dozens of meetings in this city and hundreds, if not thousands, across this country. There's a lot of work that has to be done, and we're going to do it. The great political challenge here in the United States in the 21st century is the construction of what I call a culture of human rights, a civil society, a true small d democracy that preserves the rights of individuals but also protects those who are the most vulnerable, children, seniors, the poor, the unemployed. A humane society that defends both the principles of freedom and human equality. A just society that seeks the realization of human fairness and the dismantling completely of all forms of social injustice and human inequality, whether they are based on race, class, sexual orientation, or gender or immigrant status. That is a culture of human rights that finally will include all of us, and that is the great challenge ahead of us in a democratic revolution that we must wage for human rights and human dignity here in this country and across the globe. That's the challenge that faces us. your generation of activists entering into the global struggle for justice and human rights, we must facilitate a transnational conversation moving all of us toward that culture of human rights. But it will not happen unless we all have the courage of our convictions. It will not happen unless we are unafraid, as the Quakers put it, to speak truth to power. And so this weekend, let us speak truth to power. Let us make a voice that is heard throughout the world speaking truth to power. More than ever before, the vast majority of people, working people, poor people, people struggling on fixed incomes, people in trade unions, racialized minorities here in the United States, women are being left behind economically and politically. We must redefine the democratic project here in the United States to make sure that a whole spectrum of human beings and classes and communities, groups classified or identified by their gender or sexual orientation or race or class, all have a voice at the national table. And this evening, what I want to talk about very briefly is a vantage point on how to win and fight for, in an integrated way, that struggle for a new democracy, both here in this country and a broad anti-globalization democratic movement transnationally, both for success in this country for democracy and success throughout the planet, uniting billions of people with a democratic anti-globalization vision, we must practice the politics of intersectionality. What is the politics of intersectionality? We must understand the interconnectedness of structures of hierarchy, structures of exploitation, structures of oppression. Oppression in the United States, or here or anywhere else, has never been unidimensional. From its very beginnings in this country, it was constructed around interlocking systems of prejudice, power, and white heterosexual male privilege, in which the vast majority of the American population was defined outside of the boundaries of the mainstream, what was defined as the national social contract between the people and the state. They were marginalized outside of the acceptable parameters of civil society. There was the hierarchy of race, the social construction of whiteness as a category of privilege, the racialized stereotyping of the vast majority of the non-Europeans, the genocidal exploitation and elimination of American Indians, and the vast enslavement and exploitation of people of African descent. There was the hierarchy of gender oppression or patriarchy, the beliefs in heterosexist male authority or domination, and female inferiority and subordination, the absence for centuries of voting rights and property rights for women, the deliberate uses of violence such as rape, sexual harassment, and physical intimidation to preserve white patriarchal power. There was the hierarchy of heterosexist and homophobia, the beliefs and practices that reinforced heterosexual superiority and power, and institutional discrimination and subordination against lesbian, gay, and bisexual people. And there was the hierarchy of class, the unequal distribution of the bulk of all property, productive resources, factories, banks, and financial institutions in the hands of a relatively small minority of the national population, with the great majority of us forced to live and exist only by our own labor power. The development of an ideology of class privilege that masqueraded fraudulently to the rest of the population by calling itself merit. And increasingly, the monopolization and exploitation of global resources and transnational labor exploitation to manufacture and reproduce and preserve the privileges of increasingly a transnational ruling class. The intersectionality of oppression is the center, theoretically, for the politics of a radical democratic globalization. These are the intersectionalities, the interlocking systems that define oppression, that define the realities of millions of oppressed people's lives throughout the United States and across the globe. They are the foundations of the politics of repression, the foundations in the United States of the prison industrial complex, and the politics of mass incarceration of several million people in this country, the vast human misery spawned by structural adjustment and repressive debt repayment policies, and the politics of neoliberalism and privatization across the third world, the millions of third world children who die needlessly every year to malnutrition, inadequate health facilities, and the destruction of their environment. Globalization is the new political term that we have used over the last decade to describe these institutional processes of inhumanity and exploitation and underdevelopment that has benefited, again, a relatively small number of elites, a transnational ruling class. But from the vantage point of history, in reality, globalization is not new. It is only the most recent manifestation of the predatory policies and practices of transnational capitalism. And the reality behind the specter of globalization is the cruel reality of global inequality. We can see global inequality played out in Harlem, played out in New York City, and played out in the United States every single day. The top 1% of all U.S. households own 40% of the net wealth. Financial wealth is even more heavily concentrated in the United States. The top 1% have nearly half of the financial net wealth. Since the mid-1970s, the top 1% of all households have doubled their share of the national wealth. The boom that occurred in the 1990s was a bust for millions and millions, indeed the majority, of the American working people. People talk about the politics of terrorism. What about the politics of corporate terrorism? What about the politics of Enron's corporate terrorism that destroyed the pensions of hundreds of thousands of people, that destroyed the lives of millions of working people? We should indict the corporate terrorists this weekend. This is why I love politics. Politics is the struggle to realize the specific objective interests of those who share common interests. That's Ralph Miliband's definition. But to me, the definition that operationalizes that is Frederick Douglass, the great black abolitionist, who said 150 years ago, without struggle, there is no progress. Without struggle, there is no progress. But you know, comrades, sisters, and brothers, we cannot struggle effectively, we cannot struggle well, and we certainly will not win unless we understand the interconnectedness of structures of hierarchy, of privilege, and power, I know this sounds like a theoretical argument, but if you don't have a clear sense of what we're fighting against, how can you possibly know what we are fighting for? You must have a social vision of what you want to achieve. You must have an analytical critique of the nature of the structures of inequality we are fighting against, and a broad, pluralistic, democratic approach that unites the many to defeat the few. And believe me, there's only a few of those folk downtown right now, compared to the millions and millions of people who want to fight back. I think it was enormously important that we ended the 20th century, the most important political statement of the end of the 20th century was the protest against globalized capitalism that was represented at Seattle. Over 50,000 activists went to Seattle to oppose the policies and politics of the World Trade Organization, which had at that time, for the last five previous years, functioned, as all of us know, like an international cabal and league with powerful corporate and financial institutions worldwide. Environmental activists went to Seattle in 1999 to pressure the WTO to ensure environmental safeguards that would be part of any global trade pact. Labor activists went to Seattle to force the WTO to enact trade sanctions against nations using child labor and prohibit unions that pay slave wages to workers. Since late 1999, the anti-globalization struggle has sought to link labor and environmentalists, but it has also tried to bring together, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, the struggles of people in the first world with the vast majority of humankind who lives in the third world. For us to be successful to create a counter-hegemonic global movement against the tiny handful of people who profit from the exploitation of the labor power of billions of people, we must have a politics of inclusion, we must have a politics of social transformation, and we must have a politics that unites the many to defeat the few. We must always remember that people do not struggle for abstract ideas. As the great African political activist and theorist Amilcar Cabral said, they struggle to achieve a decent life for their children. They think of politics as those things that they see around them every day. We must do the same. It is not necessary, it is not important, it is not effective to simply think of politics as a set of abstractions. We must link our values and our politics and our ideals to a language and a critique that interrogates and critiques the things, the oppressive circumstances that constitute the lived experience of most folk in the country in which we live, and link that to oppressive conditions from the Amazon rainforest to the barrios of Mexico City to the former Bantustans and tracts that constitute impoverished African people in Soweto and other cities throughout the world. We must develop a language and an analysis that can truly speak locally and theorize the struggle globally and link constituencies to see the interconnections of the nature of our struggle. Activists in the United States sometimes think that when conditions worsen, oppressed people become more desperate and will begin to demand basic change. This view, I argue, is very, very wrong. History shows that the capacity of resistance is enhanced by the winning of small victories. To achieve fundamental democratic change, we must indeed win over those with whom tonight we share common interests, but who do not tonight believe what we believe. This should not be considered a matter of political conversion, winning people over simply to our view, which is correct, but by persuading those people through the quality of our work and through the principles that we show in the practice of our politics, that meaningful democratic change can be imagined and is possible. We first must imagine the possibility of a genuine democracy in order to really win it. What most oppressed people really want is the tools to make meaningful changes in their material environment and circumstances. The struggle against globalization and corporate power must be informed by an overarching democratic vision for the realization of human rights, not a politics that emanates from the top down, but a politics of democracy from the bottom up. I want to end with the words of Audre Lorde, who once observed, quote, "For we have built into all of us old blueprints of expectation and response, old structures of oppression, and these must be altered at the same time as we alter the living conditions which are a result of those structures. For the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house." And so, my comrades, let us recognize the intersectionality of our respective oppressions. We are not alone in the fight for equality and human rights and justice. We are the many, and they are the few. Let us devise new tools to dismantle the master's house. Let us create and develop, as Audre Lorde told us, new definitions of power and patterns of relating across the boundaries of difference. Let us celebrate our diversity and our unity, a unity without conformity, to rekindle our passion for social justice that speaks a language that the world will understand. And let us build a culture of rights and struggle, of human rights in America and across the world, that will finally include all of us. Thank you.
Thank you again so much, Professor Manning Marable. Just a quick reminder that there are volunteers going around taking speaker slips. You just have to put your name. You don't have to actually have to write down your question. If you are interested in speaking at the end, asking a question or making a comment, please signal to one of our volunteers. They'll put it in a bag, and we'll pick it at random from that bag at the end. Professor Manning Marable spoke about so eloquently about speaking truth to power. Our next speaker is Amy Goodman, as many the voice of Democracy Now. And especially as we prepare for this weekend, as we already have begun this weekend of mobilizations, of coming together, teaching each other about another world, how it's not only possible but necessary. We've already seen how the corporate media, what some people call mainstream media, have represented this mobilization, this movement, this anti-war movement, this anti-capitalist movement, this movement for global justice as, well, in a certain way. So it's so wonderful when we have people speaking truth to power. Please welcome Amy Goodman.
Thank you. Well, thanks very much. It's an honor to be here with so many hundreds of you who are reclaiming the public space and proudly standing up for and protecting dissent. Because for each one of you who comes out to a meeting like this, for each one of you who goes into the streets and stands up for what you believe, you are protecting thousands of people around the world for whom it's much more difficult to stand up, who may well be facing a regime that is backed by the United States, by this government. Yes, we saw terror on September 11th in this country. 3,000 people in New York alone incinerated in a minute. Unfortunately, that terror has been experienced by people all over the world for many decades. We must rout it out here, and we must rout it out everywhere. It is a great privilege today to speak to you. How does the New York Daily News describe people like you? Legions of agitators, crazies, parasites, and kooks. But it gets a little more serious. The Daily News compared critics of the World Economic Forum to the terrorists who attacked the World Trade Center, saying, "New York will not be terrorized." And the New York Times columnist Clyde Haberman described globalization activists as people, quote, "less known for their deep thinking than for their willingness to trash cities," saying, "some would say that New York needs this protest about as much as it needs another airplane attack." Wow. This is a quote chosen by FAIR, a very important organization, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, as it depicts New York City newspapers smearing activists ahead of the World Economic Forum protests. This is extremely serious because it provides the justification, the foundation for serious police brutality, because anything seems to be justified in the face of terroristic attacks, in the face of attacks that might kill people. But who is it that is responsible for deaths around the world? As a new report that was just released today points out, a new report from the world, from the Public Citizen called Davos World Economic Forum, pricey corporate trade association loses its camouflage. They talk about who is here and the advantages that they gain, those who attend the World Economic Forum. A quote from CNN Financial News: "The World Economic Forum provides an unmatched opportunity for the world's most powerful people to bump into each other in the Congress's narrow hallways and then adjourn quietly to a back room to talk business." So you have many world political leaders who are here hobnobbing with the global corporate elite to determine the global economic agenda, which goes beyond finances, which goes to shoring up corporations, many of which have larger budgets than the world's nations. If you look at the 100 largest budgets in the world, more than half of them are not countries, they are global corporations. And what are these corporations involved with? A few years ago, I had the opportunity to go to Nigeria, Africa's most populous country, where in the last few days, thousands have died as a result of a munitions dump blowing up. But it is very important to look at militarism in Nigeria and around the world, and who has supported the regimes that have built up the forces that are so dangerous to their own people. A few years ago, I went there with Democracy Now! Producer Jeremy Scahill, and we were looking at just one oil corporation and its behavior in a place that the world's media, some of the most powerful corporations in the world, doesn't bother to look. We were looking at Chevron, which has the largest corporation based in California, Chevron, which in the spring of 1998 flew in Nigeria's notorious Navy and mobile police, known as the Kill and Go, to a community in the Niger Delta, just another community that was protesting an oil giant's despoilation, destruction of the environment, asking for some kind of reparations and cleanup. They went to a Chevron barge asking to meet with the Chevron representative, the top one, the American, who was, they knew, would be responsible, who, if he had to respond, that they could be sure something would be done. They saw the Chevron helicopters flying in, thinking that they were bringing in the negotiators, but instead they flew in the mobile police, the Kill and Go, and they landed on the barge. They opened fire on the protesters, killing two, wounding another, rounding up those that were left, putting them in Nigeria's notorious jails where some of them were tortured. This is corporate behavior. This, like those killed at the World Trade Center, those innocent people who lost their lives, is very straightforward. It's terrorism. It's terrorism in Chile in 1973 when AT&T, working with President Richard Nixon and the National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger, it's terrorism when they, working together, overthrew a democratically elected regime, and in the ensuing years, thousands of innocent Chileans were killed. It's terrorism in Guatemala when for more than 40 years, the successive Guatemalan militaries, backed to the hilt by the U.S. government, killed more than 150,000 innocent Guatemalan citizens. Yes, it's terrorism in Vietnam when 2 million Vietnamese were killed, Henry Kissinger being one of those responsible for that murderous war. These are the killing of innocent civilians like those killed at the World Trade Center. And those responsible for these massive deaths must be brought to justice, must be tried in international fora like the International Criminal Court, which has been fought covertly and overtly by the U.S. Pentagon and by the U.S. government. Why? They expressly say they're concerned that U.S. officials will be brought before those courts and tried. They don't want U.S. soldiers or officials brought and judged by an international court. Yes, someone like Osama bin Laden and his allies should be brought before that court, but we have to have a universal standard of justice, and people like Henry Kissinger must be tried as well. Now, these are the kinds of issues that should be raised on a regular basis if we had a fair media, an objective media that weighed lives equally. And that is why it is so important to support the independent media. The last time I was here in this building was just after the U.S. began bombing Afghanistan. At that time, me and many of my colleagues had been taken off the air at WBAI. But it is because of people like you around the country, pro-media democracy activists, tens of thousands of people who fought for the last few years, who fought a corporate takeover of the only independent media network in this country, and that is Pacifica Radio. And we have regained our network, and the banned and the fired have been returned to the airwaves. We do experience great victories when people are persistent, and I think that that victory, though we have a long way to go in democratizing our network, but that victory will inspire many different movements in a time of great repression when people feel like they're losing so much ground. It is absolutely critical that we celebrate the moments when we can take back the public space. Pacifica Radio, founded more than 50 years ago by a man named Lou Hill in Berkeley, California, who had refused to fight in World War II and came out of the detention camps along with 40,000 others who refused to fight then, and said there's got to be a media outlet that's not run by corporations that beat the drums for war because they profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. And that's how Pacifica was founded, with the first station, KPFA. It's why people like Paul Robeson, when banned from the airwaves all over this country and only welcome in a few black churches, knew that he could go to KPFA, the first Pacifica station, and be heard and be broadcast. He knew that there was a safe space there. And it is that safe space that grew to five stations around the country, KPFA in Berkeley, KPFK in Los Angeles, WBAI in New York, WPFW in Washington, and KPFT in Houston. KPFT going on the air in 1970, the transmitter blown up twice by the Ku Klux Klan in the first year of operation. And when the Exalted Cyclops went on trial, he said it was his proudest act because he understood how dangerous Pacifica was, because it opened the airwaves, not, I think, to the minority, but to the majority of voices that are excluded from the mainstream media that continues to beat the drums for war. I think it's no accident that one of the first protests in New York after the bombing of Afghanistan, people marched from Union Square, which had almost become a peace and democracy park until Giuliani had it cleaned up, but where people marched from Union Square to Times Square, yes, named for the New York Times, which is there now, but also the site of the Armed Forces recruiting station. Sometimes it's hard to tell the two apart. The way the media recruits for war. It is absolutely critical we support independent media and that we challenge the mainstream media, especially the corporate networks that are using our airwaves. They are the public airwaves. They are just leasing them. They're supposed to be used for the public good, not to sell military hardware like we saw in the Persian Gulf War, Westinghouse owning CBS and General Electric owning NBC, makers of most of the parts in the of military weapons in the Persian Gulf War. It's no accident that we watched a military hardware show then, as we did in the bombing of Yugoslavia, as we did and continue to do in the bombing of Afghanistan. The Pentagon understands well what bothers people, and I believe what bothers the majority of people, and that is looking at civilian casualties. And that is why it bought up the Iconos satellite imagery, the satellite imagery of the destruction on the ground that could hone in on license plates and certainly show us what civilian casualties look like. They wanted to ensure, if they got the exclusive rights, that while the war was being waged, or I should say the bombing campaign was going on, that we would not be subjected to those images that would turn a population against a military that was committing those crimes against humanity. Yes, what happened on September 11th was certainly terrorism, 3,000 people in New York alone being killed. But more than that have now been killed in Afghanistan. What happened on September 11th, the killing of people like Abe Zalmanowicz, for example, on the 27th floor, whose sister Rita Lazar condemned the loss, the deep tragic loss of her brother, who stayed behind to be with his friend Ed, who is a paraplegic, and said he'd stay with him even though he easily could have gotten out until he got help, and he went down with so many others. But Rita said and wrote a piece to the New York Times, a letter, "Not in my name, not in my brother's name." As Orlando and Phyllis Rodriguez said in a letter that didn't get published but circulated around the internet, their son, Greg Ernesto Rodriguez, who worked at Cantor Fitzgerald, they said, "Not in our son's name. Don't cause innocent Afghan fathers and mothers and sisters and brothers to grieve like we are. That will not in any way alleviate our pain." And Rita Lazar felt so strongly about this that she went to Afghanistan to bridge the sorrow with those who, like her, were the victims of a terrorist attack. She went with the human rights group Global Exchange, with others who also lost their loved ones, like Kelly Campbell. Her brother-in-law, Craig Amundsen, died in the attack on the Pentagon on September 11th. And she went with Rita and Medea Benjamin, and they traveled around Kabul, and they met a little boy who was 6 years old but seemed like an infant. Why? He was a healthy kid until the U.S. bombing campaign began and the house next door to his was bombed. He didn't seem like he'd suffered physically, but he regressed and was just a drooling baby who could no longer speak and had to be carried around, or the 10 and 11-year-old brother and sister who no longer speak because their neighbor's house was bombed and they go into spasm. She met those little kids and she thought about her brother-in-law's little children here in the United States and their loss and thought, how is it that we think in this country that it is acceptable to avenge the deaths of innocent people by killing innocent people? The polls all show, at least what's expressed on television, that more than 90% of Americans want to bomb Afghanistan. I don't believe that for a minute. I think it is critical we ask, what is the question that was asked? If people were asked, do you think the loss of innocent life should be avenged by the killing of more people? I don't think 90% of people would say yes. In fact, it would probably be completely reversed. 90% of people would say no. And so the way that the corporate media allows this to take place and beats the drums for war is to simply keep information from us, not let us see the civilian casualties, or as Walter Isaacson, head of CNN, instructed the journalists to say, the faces on TV that you see, to say if by chance they saw civilian casualties, images were portrayed on CNN, to say, don't forget the terrorists who killed the World Trade Center, who killed people at the World Trade Center or the Pentagon. Now, how is this connected to what's happening this weekend? How is this connected to the images we're seeing on television? Well, the media has done it for us. They show us the police actions preparing for this weekend to make people afraid to go out and express their dissent. I was talking to a Columbia grad student who was saying particularly foreign students are afraid to go out as we see repressive laws, increasingly the INS working with the police, afraid that they could be picked up and face more than a couple of days in jail. But we see how the police are preparing, and when you equate dissenters with terrorists, anything can happen to you. And so sane people are afraid to go out in the streets, or parents say to their children, please don't do that, don't make us afraid. And so it's the very brave people who go out and say, we understand that the kind of policies that are being discussed and pushed forward and promulgated at organizations like the World Economic Forum, of 3,000 of the world's top corporate leaders hobnobbing with politicians and global leaders, that this is dangerous. When you don't have citizen activists around the world representing civil society right in there saying there is another kind of development and globalization that will stop the vicious cycle of hatred and recrimination that leads to more attacks that we saw on our soil. It is absolutely critical that people be seen on the streets and that the media come into places like this. Yes, I see cameras, but I don't see the networks here, as I didn't see in Seattle in the first days before people went out on the streets, when an unprecedented thousands of people packed the symphony hall to hear people speak and discuss ideas about grassroots globalization. No, the media wasn't there showing that give and take, that dialogue, but instead they focused on the shattered glass. Instead, they focused on people responding to the attacks by police. That's what was violent on that day. And that, I believe, is the response we're going to see increasingly around the world, like we saw in Genoa with the killing of an activist. When you have the kind of global uprising against corporate power that we have seen in the last few years, it will be met by increasing repression, but it only shows how successful and threatening peaceful nonviolence is. And that is why you all deserve to be applauded, and all of those who haven't come out, because each one of you represents so much more than yourself. Each one of you gives hope to someone who, well, maybe they'll come out tomorrow and maybe they will go out into the streets, because they come from a place where they know it's not just an intellectual discussion or an economic idea taking power away and wealth away from those on the bottom. They have seen people die as a result. On May 20th, East Timor is going to become an independent country. This is a country that, as you know, in the last quarter of a century has faced the wrath of a military of the fourth largest country on earth, Indonesia. And that military could not have occupied East Timor and killed a third of the population if it weren't for the U.S. backing of that regime. In 1999, the people of East Timor, after 200,000 had been killed, a third of the population, finally were able to hold a vote. It's all they had been asking for self-determination. And in the face of the Indonesian military expressing its final wrath, raising that country to the ground, the people came out in overwhelming numbers and voted for their freedom. As a result of the massive destruction inflicted by the Indonesian military, supported to the end by the United States and Britain and Australia and the Western countries, the U.S. government was forced to stop supporting the Indonesian military, and that's not only for the people of East Timor, but for the Indonesian human rights activists in Indonesia itself who have faced the same guns. Those workers in Nike and Reebok plants, the workers in the Adidas factories, the workers who work for GE, they're these companies feeling safe in places like Indonesia because it's safe for business. What does that mean? It means that young women and girls know that they can't organize because they face those same weapons that the people of East Timor face just outside the factory gates. So as a result of the vote and as a result of the Indonesia's sadistic goodbye operation to the people of East Timor, after 25 years, the U.S. finally cut off its military weapon sales and training for the Indonesian government. Well, what has happened in the last few months? And this is just one example. Since Bush began waging the so-called war on terrorism, since this man who is not popularly elected president has waged war on the world, in this so-called war on terrorism, he is passing an agenda that they were trying to get passed before September 11th. What NAFTA has to do with the war on terrorism, I don't know, but they're expanding it to the whole hemisphere. What drilling in the Arctic has to do with preserving national security and homeland security, I don't know, but that's what's being pushed. What lifting the sanctions against Indonesia now has to do with saving lives, well, in fact, it's the opposite. But what Bush is doing right now is pushing back every bit of human rights legislation, protection of the public good in different parts of the world, protection of the public health in the name of national security. And people have to fight back. People have to fight back for a country that is worth fighting for, ideals and principles that are worth fighting for, that people around the globe have died for. It is absolutely critical that people stand up now more than ever. People challenge the media to tell the truth and stop reflecting the views of a minority elite, and we're not talking about people of color. That people stand up against the consensus that's hailed in Congress between the Democrats and the Republicans, who all are benefiting from corporations like Enron. It's tough to find a congressman or senator that didn't have his palms greased or his pockets lined by that corrupt corporation. Well, I applaud all of you for coming out tonight, for being part of the symposium over the weekend, for standing up for human rights for people here in this country and around the world, for standing up against the detention, particularly of Middle Eastern and South Asian people in this country. We don't even know how many people are being held. For standing up for those who are at very serious risk if they come forward. For standing up for the Afghan people who were not responsible for what happened on September 11th, but now, as a result of the cluster bombs that have been dropped on their country, now as a result of the thousands who have been killed, more people will be spawned in different parts of the world who are angry and want to take revenge. We have to break the cycle of violence and decide what we want to be. Do we want to be from the country on Earth, the number one superpower whose power is determined by the weapons it sells to repressive regimes? Do we want to be the sword, or do we want to represent to people around the world and to people here at home the shield? We have to make the decision, each one of us, the sword or the shield. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!
I want to thank you all for having me out tonight. I want to apologize that Reverend Sharpton of the National Action Network couldn't be here this evening. I am not a preacher or a scholar. I'm not the most articulate person. My words will be brief and to the point. I'm just simply a person like you all who are committed to social justice and who want to take a stand tonight. And I wanted to express the solidarity the National Action Network has with those of you who would come out and fight for this cause of standing up against the neoliberal economic order. I would first like to thank Yvonne, and actually I'd like to ask everyone who helped organize this event to please stand up. Would you please stand up and please stand up for those who helped organize this event tonight. Would you please stand up? Let's give them a round of applause. I think oftentimes we don't give ourselves enough credit for the victories we do have. It's, I think, hard in this time of so much defeat, of so much war, to recognize the victories we have. But I think if we look around, I think if we see what the media is doing today, that if we look around the world, whether it be in Washington, D.C., or Chiapas, or Argentina, or South Africa, that we have changed the whole debate on globalization. We have put forth an argument that we are not going to allow a neoliberal economic order to be forced on us, but we are demanding an agenda that put peoples first. I would like to, on that topic, I want to even mention, as Ms. Amy Goodman had brought up the Daily News, it's amazing how terrified that the World Economic Forum is of these demonstrations that we're having today. I mean, if some of you have been downtown or midtown and you see the massive security apparatus they have out there, I mean, I think it's important to understand the threat that they feel we are to their new order. And the backfire, it's happening on them. Even though they're trying to make it like, oh, these scary, violent anarchists are coming to invade and bring terror to New York, the average person in New York midtown is not mad at a protester because they haven't really seen much except for some puppet displays and for some forums. What they're mad about is the incredible security presence, the police presence, which doesn't let them get to their house, to their job, without their IDs being checked. I think the the whole order is showing its own self about the police state, which this country is becoming under this supposed war on terrorism. Now, briefly, I would like to say that I think we need to take this time today and look at it as a great opportunity. And the reason I say that is because I see that our president today is truly insane. And I see that the world is quickly realizing this. It is incredible the way he's managed to marginalize and alienate almost the entire world and the population in this country. And he's done this not from September 11th on, but from when he first came in, from when he first stole the election, and then had the audacity to tell African Americans and those who were disenfranchised, oh, just get over it. We stole the election fair and square. Get over it. There'll be another one in 4 years. But what he doesn't realize, because he doesn't know struggle, he doesn't realize that those who have struggled, those who struggled for their right to vote, those who've lost loved ones, who's lost their jobs so that their future children could have the right to vote, aren't going to just walk away and say, oh yeah, we'll forget about it. No, we fought and bled for our right to vote. We're going to continue to fight, and we're going to make sure that in 2004, the same horrific results doesn't happen again. And again, before September 11th, it was quite clear, as Ms. Amy Goodman had pointed out, that they're using September 11th, the most cheap political way to push forth their own agenda. Before September 11th, it was amazing the reaction of the administration to the protest in Vieques. The protest in Vieques where the people demanded, the people of Vieques do not want the United States to bomb us anymore. It is causing our children to be sick, asthma rates are going up, cancer rates are going up. People went over and fought. Some went to jail. And for nonviolent protests, many people ended up in jail for 2-3 months. Reverend Sharpton ended in jail for 90 days. And I was in the midst of this discussion of, is there some way senators and congressmen were writing, saying, well, why can't they let Reverend Sharpton out? Why can't they stop the bombing of American citizens when they're asking? And Rumsfeld was one of the primary people who said, if we let people have the power to determine where military bases are going to happen, even in the United States, that movement might grow around the world, and we cannot let that happen. And that is the mindset that is in this administration, that we cannot let a dissent, we cannot let people's democratic voices occur, and so we must throw them in jail, lock them up. And I think this is something that is slowly, and I think over the past 3 or 4 years, is unifying a very diverse group of people. I want to end pretty much with what Dr. King said in 1967. He said that the United States was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. And that is absolutely true today. If we just look over the last 10 years, I saw the movie Black Hawk Down, and it sickened me. It sickened me that we make a war hero story of slaughtering 1,000 Somalis in 24 hours and manage to somehow create a picture that we were the victims. We go over to a foreign land, occupy it, terrorize its people, slaughter 1,000 people in a day, and say, we were the victims in this situation. And we're doing this around the world. George Bush with his evil access of powers, talking about North Korea, a half-starving nation that's barely trying to survive, Iran and Iraq, these great terrorist nations. Even European nations, even those who have oftentimes sided with the United States are standing up and saying the United States, the Bush Doctrine, which they call it, with the Bush Doctrine being the world will submit to what we say or we will destroy them. The world is slowly standing up to that. And I want you to know that as coalitions are forged more and more around the country, people who haven't been so much involved in international economic issues, who've mostly been involved in more local civil rights disputes, are starting to see the connections, because we're all seeing the same man is coming up with the same crazy, insane policies, whether it be racial profiling, where they're locking up Arabs all across this country. And I think it was really historic about 2 weeks ago for Martin Luther King Day, instead of just having a little celebration where a whole bunch of people who had never really believed in Dr. King's dream stand up and talk about how they would have done something if Dr. King was there. Instead of doing that, we stood up with Arab Americans, with people of the ACLU in Washington, D.C., and said the King legacy demands that you speak truth to power. and that what is happening in this country is wrong. What's happening under the guise of anti-terrorism is nothing but racial profiling, and that we're going to stand together and really make King's dream a reality. So again, I would like to thank you all for having me here. Sorry again that Reverend Sharpton could not be here to give some of his words. Actually, I first want to, the sister here to the left of me had talked about, who's been very strong in supporting the issue of Palestine, had some criticisms of Reverend Sharpton, and that is fine. I understand we all have different social political ideas on different policies, but I think there's been a little misunderstanding. Reverend Sharpton comes through the civil rights nonviolent tradition. We do not only speak to those who we agree with. I agree with the sister very much that there is, the Israelis and Palestinians are not equal. There is an oppressor and the oppressed, and it's quite clear to me, and it's been quite clear to me since I was 12 years old, that the Israelis are the oppressors, and that the only thing more insane than the Bush administration today is the Sharon administration in Israel, and that it is essential that we stand up to the slaughter that is happening to the Israeli people. And it is not the Palestinian people, excuse me, and it's not just happening to the Palestinian people. I'm seeing it around the world. Now we're sending troops into the Philippines to help support the anti-terrorism efforts in the Philippines. And the same slaughter that we're now celebrating. We have the audacity now to celebrate slaughter in movie productions like Black Hawk Down. We're getting ready to do that around the world. And I just want to express to the sister that I believe the National Action Network has tried to show in solidarity with the Palestinian people, and that though we might disagree with some of our methods, you might not like the way the National Action Network struggles, you might not like the way Reverend Sharpton struggles, I might not like the way some of your organizations struggle, but as long as we stand together on principles of social justice and human rights, I believe that we can stand together and struggle. So again, I want to thank you for having me. And I finally would like to invite you all to the House of Justice, where we have community rallies in Harlem every Saturday at 10 a.m. And we're going to be talking about the World Economic Forum. You can hear Reverend Sharpton for himself speak on this issue. Have this in Harlem, 1941 Madison Avenue, right off 125th Street. You can talk to me after. So again, thank you. Let's struggle together.
Thank you so much, Cedric Muhammad, with the National Action Network doing such important work here in New York City and nationally. We are going to turn to discussion section right now. Briefly, some announcements. Because we had such a wonderfully large turnout, one, if anyone could offer housing, a couch, a floor, anything, please see a volunteer with the red hearts. It's a yellow badge, but also a red heart on it makes us a volunteer. Please stay here afterwards and see one of them. And also, if anyone got housing through us, please see us, stay here after us for those accommodations. Those are very important announcements. Part of the wonderful turnout was that so many people that came to this conference, this World Economic Forum Counter Summit, were coming from outside New York. From all across the nation came, and so we want to make sure that we keep each other safe and struggle together as our brother just said. Also, as we turn, I just want to quickly make some quick announcements. There's some wonderful workshops tomorrow, so if you could please try to make it, from immigrant rights in the wake of 9/11, to organizing labor against the war, to the globalization of poverty, to from Seattle to Johannesburg, about the failures of the Real Earth Summit and the opportunities of the UN World Summit on sustainable development, to immigrants on lockdown and the terrible racist backlash, to the struggle for justice in Palestine, and to show how all these struggles are united, and from an activist perspective. And as we turn to that, someone will be drawing the names of speakers at random from this list, and they'll call three in a row, so please make your way to the front when you are called and wait. And also I would ask that we speak to each other, speak with each other, don't speak at each other. And please respect, when I do ask you, we're going to keep each person to 1 minute for their question or comment, so please respect the moderation. Thank you. Maybe we could do it up here, and then I can call it off, or you call it up from the front there.
Okay, first three people are John Greger, Drisha Fernandez, and then there's someone who just wrote a question that says, are there any official reliable statistics of how many Afghans? I'll let you read the rest. So those three people. So the first one is John Greger, followed by Drisha, followed by the lady in the hat. And you will be held to a strict 1 minute time. We'll cut the microphone off.
Good night. I just wanted to give a comment. One thing that I come from Colombia, South America, and I share with Amy a lot of the things you said about international students and other people or immigrants being afraid of being out there. I just want to say that at the university in Colombia where I studied, our rector said in one of his discourses, where are all of us who are studying, who have different points of view of what's happening? Are we in all these big companies? Are we in the Congress? Are we pursuing political careers, economical careers? Or are we in places where we could be really having our voices heard by mainstream, et cetera?
Thank you. Who is next on the speaker list, please?
Hi, I'm John Greger. I have a PhD from Columbia. And the one thing I wanted to remark on was I was at the GAP demonstration today. Few people are aware of it, but my PhD is in physics, by the way. Few people are aware of it, but I happen to know that there is an interest in using robotics for the purpose of making garments. Some people want to develop robots that will assemble garments and make all of the garment workers of the world obsolete, out of work, unemployed, presumably except for the more skilled ones who do work which cannot so conveniently be robotized. So in addition to the capitalists playing workers of one country off against the other, the capitalists also have the possibility of introducing increased automation. Maybe someone would like to comment on that.
Thank you. Thank you. And I appreciate people keeping, as the speakers have done, to 1 minute. Thank you very much.
Hi. My question is directed towards Amy with Democracy Now! And or anyone who can answer this question. I'm interested in finding out if there are any official or reliable statistics for the number of civilians or number of Afghan civilians who have been killed in the Afghan bombing so far.
Great question. Oh, are we saving the response to me? Okay, if you want to immediate. Okay, immediate response, go ahead. I think
On the question of civilian casualties, first of all, it's very important to ask why the media has not focused on this. Mark Herold, a professor at the University of New Hampshire, since the first day of the bombing, has spent 14 hours a day collating reports, cross-checking them around the world, trying to come up with a reliable figure. You could go to our website at democracynow.org. We link to his. We talked to him about a month ago. He said between 3,500 and 5,000 people, already surpassing the number of people killed on September 11th. We haven't talked to him in the last week, but that's the numbers we're talking about. And in interviewing reporters like Robert Fisk, who's been on the ground in Afghanistan, he says that he thinks that those kind of figures are in the ballpark of the number of people who have died. And you should also call all the networks and ask them what are the reports of this to demand that they start doing an accounting.
Okay, I think we're going to take three more. Unfortunately, since we had such a wonderful and full lineup of speakers, you know, we have a limited time in this space that St. John's has been so kind to provide us with. So three more is at random.
Ginger will call the names.
The next three speakers are Andrew Pearson, Joshua Kay, and someone who didn't write their name, but starts their card with, there are so many issues, and it all seems to come down to the Palestine-Israeli conflict. Hmm. Are any of those people here? One? And you? Okay, and questions will be closed after this, and we'll do housing.
G'day. My name is Andrew. We've heard a lot about September 11th, and I just wanted to remind everybody of another September 11th that happened in the year 2000 in Melbourne, Australia. I was there, and with 15 to 20,000 other people, we shut down the World Economic Forum meeting, right? The first day, blockading, they were meeting in the Crown Casino, which was quite appropriate for the type of economics they were supporting. The police had barricaded it off, and we blockaded every single street and entrance around the way. The first day, the speakers ended up talking to an almost empty audience. None of the networking, most of the parties, and most of the schmoozing meetings were cancelled. It was a tremendous change in the Australian political debate, and people in my country have been radicalised by that, by 15,000 people making a stand. The same thing doesn't necessarily have to happen here. You know, we don't have to shut down the meeting, but the fact that people are gathering in America is also being watched by folks all over the world. And so I just want you to know that from Australia to Argentina to Brazil, all over, people are, their eyes are here, their hearts are with us, and history is behind us. Our movement has succeeded in the past, and we will win. Right?
Thank you. Next speaker.
Joshua with the Spartacus Youth Club. There was talk about unity and things and looking to Seattle as something that you can build from. But how can there be any unity in a situation where you had trade union bureaucrats such as John Sweeney, Democrat trade union bureaucrats such as John Sweeney, you know, with this national chauvinism, protectionism, calling for the dumping of Chinese steel? That's not unity. So we call for defense of deformed worker states such as China. And there's been a lot of building of illusions that capitalism can be reformed. Capitalism is a system of oppression and exploitation. We need to fight for class independence of the working class and break with the trade union bureaucrats who tie the workers in the Democratic Party. Okay. That's why we're building a United Front demonstration in the Bay Area on February 9th to mobilize blacks and immigrants, the power of labor against the boss's racist national unity campaign.
I'm sorry, we're out of time. One more question? Who's the first?
Yeah. Thanks, one more.
Okay, 1 minute.
It just seems to me that we keep finding a myriad of reasons why the corporate juggernaut is just screwing people all over the world, killing people all the time. It just seems like the bully is run amok. And my gut reaction is, if you don't stop the bully, we're all going to die. That's all. And I don't know what you're going to, what the question is, but I just think that, in my gut, I've read about this many, you know, for years. We see it all the time. There's just a new horror every day, and it just seems like unless there's something being done, the evil, the cancer, is outrunning the stopping of the cancer, and that's it. I don't know what to say.
Okay, thank you. Just a reminder to people who can offer housing, please stay and talk to one of the volunteers with a heart on their yellow badge, and also people who can who got housing through us, who need housing, please also stay and talk with us. Students for Global Justice would like to thank all of you for coming, and hope to see you tomorrow, and hope to see you in the streets this weekend.